I've really enjoyed what I've heard so far. My name is Martin Entz, and my co-author is James Frey, who's worked with me both in Canada and in Asia, where we've been dabbling with a little bit of organic agricultural research. So what I want to do today is to share some of our long-term study findings to address the question of resilience, and then also I think the other speakers have really led us up well to the discussion of how farmers deal with resilience and what are some ideas from other parts of the world. So this is our long-term study in Canada at the University of Manitoba. It's just completed 22 years, and I'm just going to give you a very quick picture of the farming system because I'm not going to go into this rotation in tremendous detail. We've got two farming systems, a grain-only and a forage grain. The grain-only is an oat-soybean-wheat-flax rotation. In conventional management and in organic management, the soybean is a green manure instead of the soybean. And the forage grain is 2 years of alfalfa and then wheat and then flax, and we have these under conventional and organic production. And so, I've got yet another definition of resilience there. This is able to become strong, healthy, and successful after something bad happens. I thought it was catchy. This data that I'm showing you from the four systems in the study really don't say much about resilience per se, but they, because they tell us what's happened over the last 20 years, it gives us a picture of what the resilient characteristics of these systems might be. And so on the left, we have the conventional spider diagrams. On the right, we have the organic. And as you may know, the further out from the middle each parameter is, the better. Okay, so if the soluble phosphorus is out to the edge, that means there's not a lot around to pollute waterways. So, and what we've seen is the organic systems perform very well in terms of ecosystem function, insect diversity, arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. But where they really have challenges are on the yield potential, on available phosphorus, and on weeds. And so I just really want to address these issues and not give you a full picture of all of the outcomes of our study. There's a new CRC book coming out next year, and this Glenlee study is one of the chapters in that book. So let's talk first about phosphorus. And this picture happens every year in our plus manure, minus manure plots where we have the forage grain system and we're harvesting it for hay. And it really demonstrates that we've got a problem where we're not adding composted manure to the system, and we think it's phosphorus. And so we, early on in this study, were telling farmers, well, your nitrogen is okay, but you need phosphorus sources. And so those can be, composted manure. You can bring in bales and bale graze on the organic land, anything to bring in phosphorus. And I think that has made the systems more resilient. And it was great that we recognized that in our study. But then we looked at phosphorus more carefully. And we had, with collaborations and graduate students, we were able to look at some of the different fractions of phosphorus because, we were always told organic agriculture is going to run out of phosphorus on the dryland prairies and this is going to limit its productivity. And what we noticed is that the available phosphorus, the easily extractable phosphorus, was indeed lower in the organic system, but the residual phosphorus was not. And so we had the idea that maybe if we included, mycorrhizal crops and phosphorus solubilizing crops in the rotation, it might actually mean that that picture on the right is not such a big problem. And indeed, our flax crops in that organic high yield system really are not bothered by that low phosphorus because they're highly mycorrhizal. Our wheat crop is bothered a bit more. When we looked at the mycorrhiza more carefully, these are spores from 100 grams of soil, on the right the organic, on the left the conventional, and you can see the phosphorus concentrations there. We did see that we did indeed have more mycorrhizae in the organic system, or at least the spores that are going to germinate and form the mycorrhizae. And that's quite exciting. So that actually is happening. And we have now a lot of questions about phosphorus. And even the conventional ag people are looking at this saying, this is kind of interesting. Maybe we could operate agriculture at lower levels of available phosphorus and supply the phosphorus to plants biologically through these greater biological activities. So that's kind of where our phosphorus story is right now. And yeah, does less available phosphorus make the soil more resilient? Well, based on this picture, perhaps, you know, you can answer that question for yourself. We recently had a chance to look at the phosphorus even more carefully. We looked at microbial organic phosphorus over one growing season. And this was a year where it was very dry in the middle of the summer, 2011, and then we had re-wetting of the soil in the autumn. And quite fascinating, we have a prairie, a restored prairie in our rotation, and it had the highest organic or microbial phosphorus. But what was interesting is the conventional system had actually the lowest, and the organic, with no input, no manure, had the highest. And so there's a lot going on here. By restricting phosphorus inputs, we're somehow getting more microbial phosphorus. Maybe that's where the phosphorus is, and that's how we should design our thinking. So that's kind of the state of our phosphorus knowledge, and I think there's some good new hypotheses there. The other two major challenges to the resilience of the system were very much agronomic ones. And so instead of sticking with it, we continue to have our long-term study running, but we also set up this more active organic farm, at another research station that we have, which has more forgiving soil, and I have to agree with the last speaker, you know, it makes weed control and things easier. And we set up a six-year crop rotation to look at what organic crops would do under sort of more optimum production conditions. And we set up a six-year crop rotation with a green manure crop every third year, and one of those green manure crops is grazed. We used some occasional no-till. We've heard about that today. And so on the upper right, you can see some oats no-tilled into hairy vetch barley mulch, some flax in the middle no-tilled into mulch, organic wheat on the bottom left, and organic soybeans on the right. And this was very helpful. And these are the yields, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them, but the productivity of these organic crops is much, much greater, and it's certainly better than in our long-term study where we have a static system on some difficult-to-manage soils. And I just wanted to show you the picture of our livestock integration. I'm an agronomist, and I now, you know, fill out animal care forms, and that's fun because we have these sheep, and we've been getting more creative in our green manure systems. Instead of just growing things like peas and oats, we now undersow them to ryegrass, so we get season-long grazing. We're making the systems more productive. And so that, what we call the sunshine farm, is performing quite well. And if we look at, this is based on a study that we recently conducted, when we compare our conventional production on our research farm to our sunshine farm production, we're using about 35% as much fossil fuel in our organic system. We're having a greater conversion of energy efficiency. We're not producing quite as much human usable energy yet, but we're working on it. And the net return is a little lower. So when we take that new knowledge from our sunshine farm back to our long-term study, which is what we've done, and here I'm showing you the wheat yields just for since 2008, since we've started interrow cultivating and doing some of these things that we've learned, we're feeling very good about ourselves, because which umbrella would you rather stand under in a rainstorm, the one on the right or the one on the left? Well, the one on the right. But then we had an Australian visitor, Lindsay Bell, on the left, come and visit us, and we looked at soil carbon right down to 1.2 meters, and we discovered that these organic systems actually had quite a bit less soil carbon at depth. and that concerned us. I'm not going to go through the data, but it's published in Ag Ecosystems and Environment. I was planning for a 30-minute talk, and I just realized I only have 20 minutes. So I'm skipping a few slides. I hope you don't mind. So we're emphasizing carbon. We're thinking about carbon fertilization. This term actually makes me happy. I like the idea. And this is where we're learning things from other parts of the world, like organic systems in the tropics. And so where we are right now at home in our sunshine farm is we're adding trees to our system in an effort to increase the carbon input into the farming system, into the organic farming system, and we'll use our livestock to do some moving that carbon and the nutrients through nighttime corralling and things like that, which we have experimented with over the last year. So that's our story with our long-term studies at home. I want to shift and talk a little bit about the farmers, because when we think about resilience, I often think about what happens to those farmers who attend our field days and then go home and practice organic agriculture either on a big scale or a small scale. How are they doing? And how resilient are they? Are they staying with organic? What problems are they running into? So James and I had a chance to study 10 of these farmers, and this will be another chapter in that Taylor and Francis CRC book, which is coming out next year. And what we were interested, what James was interested in, because he's a social scientist, is how are the farmers doing along this sort of adaptive learning cycle? Now, I'm sure many of you have seen this buzz hauling adaptive cycle before, but the way it works is people will come in on the sort of the R level, the bottom left, and they'll find a new practice and they'll move up to the K, and they'll say, this is a great new practice, I want to do this into the future, and then all of a sudden there's a problem with what they've done, and to be resilient they need to move on from that practice, reorganize and come back. And so we've looked at that cycle this way in our book chapter, and we've put it into the context of organic agriculture, and we're particularly interested in this phase of the cycle, is when things don't work, when the phosphorus runs out, when whatever happens, what can we offer those farmers to help them adapt their systems and make them truly resilient or more resilient. And then I have a lot of questions, like how many times, in a decade does a farmer have to go around that cycle? Probably all the time, and maybe Jeff wants to, as a farmer, he wants to comment on that later. I'd love to hear from him. Okay, so that's a bit of what we've done at home, and when I was invited to give this talk, I thought I would challenge myself by saying, well, I'm going to, is that 5 minutes?
You've got 5 minutes left.
That's why you're up? Okay, thanks. I would look at what's happening in another part of the world, and of course in Asia, the Japanese have been doing organic farming. That's not really what I'm going to talk about. I'm interested more in the smallholders, and IFAD said that organic farming, because it's primarily knowledge intensive, really is well suited to smallholder farmers. And I just wanted to show these three pictures to emphasize something, to remind myself, to tell you that I think when we're talking about smallholder farmers, we don't really want to get caught up in labels. Those are all pictures that I've taken in different type of international work, and I think we need to be thinking about what's in the best interest of smallholders. When I look at statistics like this, where the UN estimates that two-fifths of humanity will live in urban slums by 2030. I think, anything we can do to keep smallholders on their farms, or at least to give them a choice to be on their farms, is important. And so whether that's organic or not, it probably doesn't matter so much. But there are movements for organic agriculture in China and India, for example. The motivations are slightly different. But I think we can learn a lot from these countries. Feeble out of Switzerland is now working in India. They have established long-term experiments there, and Feeble has a almost 40-year organic conventional comparison study in Switzerland. So they've got a lot of experience. And I just wanted to... I was interested in this because this is where James and I have some experience. We've been working with smallholder organic farmers and then large commercial farmers, either in North Korea or in Northwest China. And the who is in a better position to become organic? It's definitely the traditional or the rustic farmers. These other farming systems that are centrally planned, or on the bottom right-hand side, you can see that Northwest China, there's all kinds of plastic being used. I'm racking my brain, how are we going to, have an organic form of plastic in an area where, mulch is really precious and the carbon is hard to grow because it's so dry. So maybe there is something to getting rustic farmers doing organics. And this is I'll end with this story from our work in Central America. These are two tomato crops. The one on the bottom right is organic. The one on the top left is fertilized with mineral fertilizers. It's not as resilient. This was a wet spring, and where there was some compost added to the land, those tomatoes did a lot better. And that farmer, from the produce of that tomatoes, was able to buy 6 cows. And that was that's a mutual fund for a family. I just want to, I guess this is my last slide. Final point, if we're going to make systems resilient, I ask myself, what makes a good recipe, like a food recipe? Well, food recipes improve with use, right? People are always sharing recipes. And that's because, there's no intellectual property rights on baking soda and on flour and on raisins. And when I think this will really help us in organic agriculture as well, is to keep things open access. And now with the internet and all the other social media tools, we can communicate with each other. I have a graduate student. He's sitting right there. He's going to be moving halfway around the world to do his work, but he's no longer isolated from the other graduate students that are sitting here because they can talk to each other. And I'd like to challenge us to think about open access, not just in terms of information or planting rates, but also seeds. And so the newest part of our program is we've started a farmer participatory breeding program with 5 crops in Canada. We give segregating populations to the farmers, and then we say, have a nice life. No paperwork. So we're working with potatoes and wheat and corn and oats and carrots. And so I think the boss is telling me I'm done, so thank you.